Yeah, I think the what we think of as the inhabitants of the spiritual realm. In other words, intelligent beings that are not terrestrial, in any sense. That happens before 1-1. I don't put any credence at all in what is popularly called a gap theory, and that's because it violates Hebrew grammar and syntax. Genesis 1:1 through 3, if you're paying attention to Hebrew, and I'd suggest it's a good idea since that's what the Old Testament was written in, it is not a linear sequence. There are different ways it can be interpreted as a non-sequential set of circumstances. And if people are interested in this, they could go to my website, drmsh.com, and click on Naked Bible, and then click on videos and look for the talk on Genesis 1:1 through 3. You could probably just go to my website and in the search field put Genesis 1:1 through 3, and you'd find the video anyway. But I did a whole session on this in church. So yes, you can actually talk about Hebrew grammar and syntax and have it be understandable. It's well worth a listen because there are certain ways that you can read the first three verses and certain ways that you can't. Again, if you're paying attention to Hebrew. And so that's what I try to show in that passage. But as far as the specific question, it's a before, not a between. The divine being that we know as God's enemy in the Garden of Eden, I think the moment he decides to speak to Eve and set her up, that is when the rebellion in his formed in his heart, using that expression, and he became an adversary. He became a rebel at that point. And I think, again, I talk about this in the unseen realm a lot about what the motivation for this might have been. And I do take it. I think the divine rebellion expresses a desire on the part of the rebel to usurp God's authority, question his decisions, and presume that you could have done better, that you would have made a different and a better decision than the God who created you. And so I think it when God announces his intention to create humanity with all of its implications that we're gonna God's gonna create, that he created humans now, and we're all gonna like them, and part of they're gonna be part of this family and part of God's administration of the stuff that he makes, wherever that stuff is, whatever realm we're talking about. Humanity was lesser. Okay, we learn this from Psalm 8. You've created him, humans to be a little lesser than the Elohim. And there is some sense of offense there, at least on the part of one, initially one, who disagrees, for whatever reason or whatever the logic trail would be, disagrees with either the wisdom of that decision or the decision just on its face value. Who are these creatures who are embodied, who are lesser than us? Why invite them into this family, into this situation? Why do they have charge of this place and we don't? Whatever the precise motivation would have been, there's an offense there. And one of the divine beings exercises their freedom, the communicable attribute of freedom, to make his own choice, a choice that puts him in an adversarial relationship with God. I think, when Job, in Job 15, the comment is made that Yahweh doesn't trust his holy ones, I do think it goes back to this event and other events, but I think that the principle is even bigger than that. If you put it's one thing to possess, to share divine attributes, freedom being included in that. It's quite another to possess those attributes in their fullness and also possess God's nature. We don't do that. We possess, God's attributes. We share them to lesser degrees, and the Elohim share them too, to a lesser extent than he possesses them. But none of us have God's nature. The potential is always there, either in our realm, our imaging realm, and their imaging realm, for them to go astray, for them to act in self-will, for them to not want to be governed, again, to presume that we want autonomy. That's always there because we and they do not have God's nature. Only God has God's nature by definition. And so I think the moment that autonomy, you know, popped into the head of the Nahash, as he's referred to in Genesis 3, that was the point of his demise and sets him up for a punishment. Now he, you know, the better question is, did he care?
Right.
Because I have to think he knows he's not getting away with this. But does he despise humanity so much, or does he despise the governance of Yahweh so much that I'm willing to risk punishment just to have them eliminated? You know, because he said you're going to die. Now, it's very easy to read that and think that, okay, if I get them to sin, God's going to destroy them.
Right.
And that'll make me happy anyway. Of course, God doesn't do that. Now, they lose their immortality, which was contingent anyway, you know, even in the garden. But they lose their immortality. They're removed again from the divine presence, i.e. the tree of life, that helps perpetuate, again, this contingent immortality. And they are going to age. They are going to die. And the rebel is cast down. He becomes Lord of the Dead. And what that means is that because of this set of events, humans are going to die. They're removed from the divine presence. There is no more Eden until it gets reestablished. You know, the whole thing just blows up. And so humanity is now estranged from God. They're mortal. They're estranged from God. Every one of them will die. And that means that this being, until the launch of the kingdom of God, in any way, has claim on their soul. And it's only by the grace of God that anyone who aligns himself in this life with, you know, the offer of grace, the offer of salvation, forgiveness, believing loyalty is how I like to describe it in the book. That's the only escape. And it, to me, it's kind of interesting that once the kingdom of God actually gets started with the true king, that this is during the Gospels, it's only at that point that Jesus says, "I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven." And I take that as that reference. I think the rebel was cast down to begin with back in Genesis. I don't think he has access, you know, to the divine council anymore or anything like that. But I think that what the language points to is that this being had claim, you know, over the souls of humanity. But when the kingdom of God becomes real, and the focal point of the kingdom, how you get into it, the Messiah, Jesus, is actually here. And the plan of God is going to be enacted that triggers everything in terms of salvation. That at that point, the messaging is this: look, every member of this kingdom, the kingdom of God, okay, you don't have any claim on them. So just shut up. Okay, just <Yeah. laughs> shut up. You know, you can accuse, you know, people, you can say, well, they're mine because they're mortal. You know what? If they're a member of my kingdom, their mortality is no longer an issue because I'm going to rise. I mean, they don't have a conversation like this because the plan is secret.
Right.
But Jesus knows I'm going to rise, and they're going to rise with me. Okay. That is the point. Again, when all of this gets triggered and that's why I think Jesus announces it, because it happens right after he sends out the 70, you know, the whole telegraphing of "I'm here," and he starts poking the unseen powers in the eye. You know, I spent a lot of time on this in the book about how Jesus baits the powers of darkness into killing him, because that is what needs to happen. That's the thing they don't know. They know he's here, but they don't know what the plan is, and so they're, oh well, let's just kill him. You know, that'll solve everything. You know, not. You know, they're duped, not realizing that this is precisely what will lead to your undoing. And so Jesus goes to certain places and says certain things and just pokes them in the eye. Come and get me. you know, and there are two, I don't want to give all the content of the book, but there are two that are especially significant. And right after the second one happens, that the gospel says, and from this point forward, he began to speak to his disciples about his death. And a week later is the triumphal entry. And then a week after that, he's dead. I mean, it's choreographed. It's strategic. You know, it's just not laid out there accidentally. Jesus knows precisely what he's doing. And again, you know, going back again to the original question, sorry for the rabbit trail there, but.
Oh, that's totally fine.
I think all of this is, you know, in play, and all, and these are dots that need to be connected.
Yeah.
You know, as far as what's going on there, what the attitude was and how it needs to be dealt with.